The idea of us emerging from social distancing by Easter died yesterday. Cases of COVID-19 in our country and our state continue to spiral upward, and the federal guidelines, two states got a two-week extension. So the month of April, not even started, will likely see a continuation of the restrictions keeping us apart. What will be the signs of the potential end of the restrictions? Our next guest has given this some thought. Dr. Ralph Eccles is a retired endocrinologist in Klamath Falls. He joins us now with some perspective on coronavirus and its effect. Dr. Eccles, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
So there's been nothing like this in more than a century. We've talked about that a lot. Nothing like this since the Spanish flu, which finally seemed to have lost its power in 1920. But over your career, did you have a feeling that something like this could happen at some point?
Well, we always think about the possibility of some kind of a disaster happening, and among those would be a huge virus that could spread rapidly. As Dr. Anthony Fauci has pointed out, the biggest fear of virologists and epidemiologists who follow this sort of thing is a respiratory virus that can easily be transmitted from one person to another. So we had the SARS epidemic in 2003 and the MERS in 2013, but the ability of the virus to go from one person to another was nothing like what we're seeing now. And this may even be more contagious than the virus, the H1N1 virus that we saw in 1918 and 1919.
Okay, so this is even beyond SARS and MERS, you're saying, too?
Oh, very much so. That's part of the reason we were able to quickly control SARS and MERS without it spreading all over the world and hitting every country in huge numbers. This is a far more contagious virus.
All right, which is the major concern for keeping people apart. It can spread that much more easily. So give us some basic virus lessons, if you would, Ralph, because I know that in the way that we tend to view our opponents, and this is certainly an opponent, we tend to portray them as some sort of bloodthirsty creature, but they're not even quite creatures, it turns out.
No, a virus isn't really a living organism. It has no respiratory capabilities like bacteria. You can't see it under a regular microscope because it's far too small. It's just a small particle that consists of a little bit of genetic material, either RNA or DNA. Most of them are RNA, a little bit of protein. And in the case of the coronaviruses, they also have lipids, which is a fatty substance around their outside, which dissolves very quickly with soap and water. Don't need an antibacterial soap. They're not a bacteria. So plain soap and water. Now, viruses come in different groups, and there are 39 in the group called coronavirus. And when this new virus showed up, it was given a name, AY351680.0. Kind of cumbersome name, but that's what most viruses get for a name. Shortly after it began to spread, the World Health Organization felt it needed to be given an easier name, and we came up with COVID-19, but that's really the name of the disease. Mm-hmm. And eventually, the International Committee on Taxonomy of Viruses named it SARS-CoV-2, because it was so similar to the SARS virus of 2003. The big difference, though, is far more contagious, and it appears also to be more deadly. So a virus gets into our body usually because we inhale it, and it gets to our nose and starts growing there, and then, in this case, it goes down to the lungs and makes us really sick. Then we cough and spread the virus to somebody else. The virus is nothing more than something that can attach to our cells, and then it hijacks the cell and makes the virus reproduce itself. But the body tries to fight it off. That causes inflammation, so you get a stuffy nose. And in worst case, your lungs swell up, and then you have to stop breathing, and then we need ventilators.
There's something reminiscent here.
It's not alive. Yeah, go ahead.
There's something reminiscent here of cancer in the sense that the body can fight off both viruses and cancer up to a point, but there seems to be a point at which the ability of the virus or the cancer to replicate itself is where the problems really begin.
That's true. And so it appears, particularly when we look at the data from Germany, because Germany is doing a huge amount of testing, including a large number of asymptomatic carriers. This virus in most people does very little, but it's those severe cases where it gets down in the lungs and then the body tries too hard to fight it over, and the inflammation swells up the tissues in the lungs so you can't get oxygen in there anymore. So, yes, like cancer, the body's designed to fight off infections, but sometimes that fighting mechanism goes haywire.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are viruses around and in us all the time, aren't there?
Well, there are viruses around all the time, and some viruses may have set up a permanent residence within us. This is particularly true of, say, chickenpox. These are the rare forms of viruses that have DNA, which is identical to the genetic material in our own bodies. Most viruses have RNA, and they don't stick around in us very long. Although we might have a few, particularly those that like to attach to bacteria. The problem is the virus, when it goes from one person to another, can change. And sometimes it becomes more dangerous, or as we say, virulent. It causes more infection. More often, it just becomes more contagious. It gets easier to spread.
We're talking to Dr. Ralph Eccles here at the Jefferson Exchange, a retired endocrinologist from Klamath Falls, who has offered his expertise on understanding what's been going on with COVID-19 and the coronavirus that causes it, and when we might actually begin to consider benchmarks that would indicate maybe this thing is finally passing. We haven't gotten there yet, that's for sure. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the idea of an RNA-only virus as opposed to DNA, and SARS-CoV-2 is actually an RNA virus, right?
Yeah, actually, most viruses are RNA viruses. that allows them to replicate really quickly because they just move into our cell, attach to the endoplasmic reticulum, which reads RNA, and force the cell to read the RNA from the virus, so it makes more copies of itself. Now, to stop that, there are some drugs out there which can prevent the virus from attaching or prevent the virus from hijacking the RNA in our own system. We also develop vaccines which improve the ability of the body to fight the infection by increasing the number of antibodies in our immune system to fight that infection. The problem we have right now is that we don't have a really good, well-known, highly available medication, and it'll probably take 18 months to 2 years to develop a vaccine that can be distributed. In this case, we need to send it worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get everybody all over the world because people are traveling all over the world, and if we stamp out the virus in the United States and it spreads all over Africa, it'll come right back to the United States. So those kind of things we're talking about take a long time. What we need to figure out is we can isolate so people don't spread the virus one to another. But how long do we do that, and how do we stop isolating? We can't just say April 30th, we're all going to go back to work.
Right.
Because the virus will just come back, and although we may have a lot of ICU beds available, they'll be overwhelmed again, just like they are right now in New York.
Since viruses do mutate so easily, are viruses constantly outstripping efforts to develop vaccines to stop them?
Well, DNA viruses don't. So you can get a measles vaccine and it'll protect you after a couple of shots for the rest of your life. But RNA viruses really do. That's why the flu vaccine that we were giving out in October doesn't seem to be working right now. And there's actually more influenza out there than there is coronavirus. It's just that we don't worry as much about influenza for most of us.
All right, so you pointed out that separation is good. Short of having people show up to work and school in rubber suits with full canned air supply, I mean, is there anything else we could do?
Well, that's what we have to look at. And one thing that has been discussed is the idea of tracking down those healthy individuals who've been exposed. And so, for example, we know a lot of those people in Germany. Isolating the antibodies out of those people by drawing some of their blood and having them donate it, and then we process it. And then those antibodies could be injected into people that are especially sick. That would spare people having to go to the ICU, but it wouldn't be a treatment that would cover all the people. One thought is that maybe we could get used to all wearing masks. a regular mask doesn't protect you from the virus, but it protects everybody else from you if you have the virus. The other thing to consider, Germany is not just testing what's called a PCR test, where we look for the virus. That's a test we're doing in the United States. But they're also doing a blood test that looks for the antibody in people 2 weeks later. Are their bodies developing immunity? And Germany is talking that at some point they'll let up the relaxation for those people who've shown immunity, and maybe some other younger, healthier people would also be allowed to associate with them. They'll get the virus but not get sick enough to get really sick, and then they'll get immunity too, so that eventually we'll have enough people that are immune to the virus that it'll have a difficult time spreading around the population in general.
This is herd immunity, isn't it, where you get enough people exposed that it should buffer the entire population, you hope, anyway?
Well, you hope. Now, it's difficult. You can't really buffer the elderly, who are highly prone to getting very sick from this disease, and you can't buffer people who have an immune system that doesn't work right now, including a lot of our cancer patients and a lot of people with autoimmune diseases that take drugs to suppress it. So that is a problem, but it might allow factories to reopen or stores to reopen and some people to be able to go shopping. What I think is that we don't have a good answer. And I'm calling on Governor Brown and Governor Inslee to maybe put together some of the smart people from the universities here in Oregon and Washington, virologists, epidemiologists, actuarials, ethicists, is it okay to allow herd immunity? And come up with a plan and tell us what that plan is. Germany has stated that their plan will be developed by a team of experts, and they're announcing who those experts are. So people know that there's experts working on coming up with a plan. All they've said is they won't implement the plan until the virus cases stop duplicating, and so the duplication rate when the virus first hit Germany was every 2 days, it doubled the number of people infected. Now it's every 3.5 days it's doubling. When it gets to the point that only every 10 days is it doubling, because they've implemented these controls, then they feel they can address who gets to come out of controls. Will they let universities open, but not grade schools, because grade schools who have small kids who can bring the virus back home to parents and grandparents? Those questions haven't been answered yet, but people are doing mathematical models, including people at the University of Washington, to try to figure out the answer to those questions. It would be nice if we could hear it.
Indeed. Our guest again on the Jefferson Exchange is Ralph Eccles, a retired endocrinologist living in Klamath Falls. You can join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. But is it really that simple? I mean, well, you mentioned Germany. Now, our situation is different because we're still way behind the curve in getting people tested. So might it take even longer? Might our numbers be somewhat different than, say, for example, the 10 days doubling?
Well, using 10-day doubling is only accurate if you have good data. And Germany right now is at their maximum capacity for testing. So they've tested a lot of asymptomatic people, but probably next week they won't be able to do that anymore. So now they're saying maybe we have to wait longer than the 10 days. The United States is way behind the curve on testing, and we're only testing for the virus. We're not testing for antibodies against the virus. So we don't know what the percentage of people are that have carried the virus, not gotten sick from it, let alone what is the percentage of people that are immune to the virus and should be allowed to go back to work because they can neither transmit it nor can they get sick from it. That is a problem that's going to take some time. We're going to need labs all over the United States and the rest of the world who can develop test kits, because Germany's supplying labs or test kits to most of Europe, so they're swamped right now.
We have an email here from a listener, from Susan, no town given. She wants to know if stomach viruses are different from the ones in your upper respiratory tract, and if so, how?
So stomach viruses come in different forms. There's other groups. Norovirus is probably one of the most common and easily highly spread. In this case, the virus remains on the fingers of somebody who's preparing food, then you eat the food and the virus replicates in your stomach. So these viruses attack the lining of the intestine and then spread throughout the rest of the body if they do spread. Sometimes they just stay in the intestines. You get vomiting and diarrhea, and that's the end of it. Whereas this virus, all coronaviruses, go into the nose first and then spread through the body, particularly in this case, it really likes the lungs. This virus can attach to the inside of our lungs better than it can to any other part of our body. But when it spreads, it's interesting because the virus, when it spread in China, went to the liver and caused liver problems in the people that were really sick. In the Washington, the virus is not going to the liver, it's going to the heart, causing heart problems. So the virus has changed since it left China. Unfortunately, it's still deadly.
Well, are you concerned that there will be several waves of this virus, that even if we've developed some immunity after it passes through once and we've gotten to the point where the doubling amount has gotten much farther apart, that we could, if people start coming out, that boom, it could happen all over again?
Well, if we just suddenly stop our physical isolation, we're not really socially isolated. I'm talking to you, but I'm clear over here in Klamath Falls. But we're physically isolating ourselves. If we suddenly stop that, we're going to get a second wave. And we can probably begin to see that happening in China if they release their data. So that is concern. What we also know from other coronaviruses is that over time, but now we're talking months or even years, viruses tend to change in a way that they are less dangerous but more contagious. So this very same coronavirus that's putting people in the ICU today may just cause a bad cold in 5 or 6 years from now.
Interesting. So it would still be a SARS-CoV-2, but its virulence, its ability to do bad things to us would not be as pronounced.
That's highly likely. You can't know for sure, but that's the way most coronaviruses change. There's a couple of coronaviruses going around right now just causing the cold. It throws the testing off when we're looking for a specific coronavirus and somebody comes up with coronavirus and we have to then find out which ones.
So, Ralph, we're almost out of time. It sounds like it's going to be a while longer, as we've been saying hearing from a lot of other quarters.
Yeah, the last thing I'd like to say is we should look at what Abiy Ahmed, who's the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, said. This virus respects no borders. We need the whole world to work together to tackle this kind of invisible, vicious adversary. But it requires global leadership.
All right. We will see if we get that in the days ahead. Ralph Eccles is an endocrinologist and former OHSU worker and living in Klamath Falls now. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right, take care. Hope to talk to you soon. That'll do it for this hour of the Jefferson Exchange. Stay safe. We got an hour or two coming up.